On September 30th, 2024, the Bozeman Area League of Women Voters, the American Association of University Women, the Bozeman Public Library, and the Belgrade Community Library Foundation sponsored a forum to discuss CI 128, an upcoming ballot initiative. The event was held at the Bozeman Public Library.
Welcome, everyone, to the Bozeman Public Library. My name is Beth Boyson. I'm one of the Adult Services Librarians here at the Library. Thank you for attending this ballot initiative forum. This forum is for information only and does not endorse or promote any vote for or against issues on the upcoming ballot. This meeting is being recorded by KGBM, 95.9 Gallatin Valley Community Radio, and will be available to listen to as a podcast on their website. As a friendly reminder, absentee ballots for the election will be mailed out Friday, October 11th, and can be returned by mail or in person from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday at the Gallatin County Election Office in Bozeman. Ballots are due and must be received by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 7th. A special thanks to our forum sponsors, Bozeman League of Women Voters, the American Association of University Women, Bozeman Public Library, and Belgrade Community Library. Shall we begin?
Okay. My name is Sally Mason. I'm with the League of Women Voters. And the organization, this forum tonight, is that the pro-128 will have 20 minutes to give their presentation, and the con will also have 20 minutes. We're going to start with the pro. Before we get started, though, I want to say to all of you, I understand totally that this is a very contentious issue, and people feel strongly both ways. And I am insisting that we are civil and polite, and no sneering, jeering, clapping, carrying on tonight, please. So, and after that, after the 20 minutes apiece, then I'll take questions from the audience. Okay, we're starting with the pro. Alex?
Well, I was hoping for chicken wire up here tonight, but apparently the league decided to take it down before we got started. My name is Alex Raitt. I am the deputy director and legal director for the ACLU of Montana. I live over in Livingston. And thank you to the league for inviting us to speak in support of this very important initiative that will be on the ballot in about a month. Before I get started, I do just want to note the irony of two men sitting up here debating an issue that obviously impacts women across the state of Montana. This is, as Sally said, a very contentious issue and one that we believe is very important, and that's the reason why this constitutional initiative has been placed on the ballot, so that the voters can speak. The ACLU of Montana is one of many local Montana organizations that are supporting this initiative. I see some of our friends in the back with Forward Montana and Planned Parenthood of Montana. This is very much a homegrown effort to essentially enshrine the right to an abortion in the Montana Constitution in perpetuity. Beth, if you could go to the next slide, please. So a lot of people ask me right out of the gate, why are we doing this now? And the reason is that for decades we have seen attack after attack after attack on the right to make private decisions about whether and how to have an abortion. In the last several legislative sessions, we have seen dozens of bills advanced by political extremists that are designed to essentially restrict abortion or ban abortion altogether. All of those bills have been the subject of lawsuits, of which I have participated in many, and they have been struck down by the courts. But we know, as a result of what we saw with the Dobbs decision recently that overturned Roe v. Wade, that judicial decisions can be overturned. And so we all decided that enough was enough, and it's time for this issue to be put to bed once and for all, and that is what CI 128 is designed to do, is to enshrine in our Constitution, in the Declaration of Rights, the right to abortion. And when I talk about sort of why now. We have seen the types of laws that enacted that go from an outright abortion ban to targeted restrictions on abortion providers that seek to regulate them out of existence, to arbitrary decisions about who can provide an abortion. So again, we see these attempts to restrict an individual's right to choose over and over and over again, which is why it's so important that we vote yes on CI 128. If we can go to the next slide, please. So it hasn't been easy to get this initiative onto the ballot. And we knew when we filed the language for the proposed initiative about a year ago that when we did that, that all sort of corners of state government would mobilize into action to prevent this issue from being presented to the voters. And indeed, that happened right out of the gate. We submitted our proposed initiative language, which is very clear and which I'll walk through in a minute, to the Attorney General as required by law. The Attorney General arbitrarily decided that the language was procedurally defective, which required us to immediately institute and initiate an action before the Montana Supreme Court, seeking the court to put its rubber stamp on the initiative process and allow it to proceed. We went back and forth and back and forth with the Montana Supreme Court, and ultimately the court determined that indeed the language that we had proposed was sufficient and should be sent to the voters. That kicked into action an intense window of activity where we went into signature gathering mode because there is a threshold requirement of about 60,000 signatures that's necessary to qualify an initiative for the ballot. Those need to be geographically dispersed in various state legislative seats across the state. And so we mobilized across the state. We talked to voters across the state, and we'll talk about sort of what that looked like in a minute. But again, we knew that we had to protect on the rear flank against these types of actions by state actors to prevent this initiative from being presented to the voters. And sure enough, once we had qualified the initiative for the ballot, the Montana Secretary of State made a midstream and dark of night decision to disqualify otherwise qualified electors for purposes of counting the initiative. So once again, we were back in court, this time in district court in Helena, arguing that the Secretary of State improperly was ignoring those forms, those signatures that otherwise would have been validly counted. And we won again. And so we have now had multiple court decisions validating the effort that we undertook to qualify this important initiative for the ballot. And outside of the legal arena, we've also seen all sorts of efforts to intimidate voters, to intimidate our signature gatherers. There was a signature gatherer in Helena that I observed who was being shouted at and filmed by opponents of the measure. And there is no sort of place for this type of intimidation and threats and violence in the context of a valid political process. These are merely people who are permitting Montanans to exercise their right to vote, their right to support an initiative, and their right to ultimately pass this when it's placed or when it appears on the November ballot. So if we could go to the next slide, please. So in the face of this opposition from state actors and from intimidation, we did it. And we didn't just do it by the hair of our chinny chin chin. We did it with overwhelming support. As I said, the minimum threshold for qualifying a measure for the ballot is around 60,000 votes. Well, we doubled that. We gathered the most signatures in support of a ballot initiative in Montana history, and we turned in 117,000 total signatures in support. And we did that with the help of 500 volunteers across the state. These were people who were donating their time, who felt compelled to support this initiative, and who stood outside the Bozeman Public Library and asked people to sign a petition in support of placing the measure on the ballot. So we're very, very proud of the way that this measure qualified, and we're enormously gratified by the outpouring of support that we have seen, not just in places like Bozeman or Helena or Missoula, but all across the state. We were in every county in the state. We were talking to rural voters, urban voters. We were talking to voters on reservations. And again, we could not have done this without an overwhelming outpouring of support for abortion rights in Montana. We can go to the next slide, please. So let's talk about what CI 128 is. So as I mentioned, and I sort of get nerdy about the Montana Constitution because I just love this document. It was adopted in 1972. It's a modern document that reflects the values of a modern Montana, things like individual dignity, things like an explicit right to privacy, a right to a clean and healthful environment. And CI 128 very, very much fits with the ethos of the Montana Constitution. And what CI 128 would do is amend the Constitution in our Declaration of Rights to expressly provide that there is a right to make and carry out decisions about an abortion free from government intrusion, and it would prohibit the government from arbitrarily denying or burdening that right to an abortion before viability. I mentioned that these other anti-abortion laws that have been enacted by the legislature have been struck down by the Montana Supreme Court and district courts across the state. Those decisions have come from a 1999 Montana Supreme Court decision called Armstrong v. State. That was a challenge to a law that required that only MDs, only docs, could provide abortion services. And it's clear that under the established standards of care that other qualified health care providers can provide an abortion. And so CI 128 very much captures the spirit of the Armstrong decision and explicitly embeds it into our Declaration of Rights. So a vote yes on CI 128 ensures, again, that the government cannot deny or burden an abortion when necessary to protect the patient's life or health. It prohibits the government from denying or burdening the right to abortion before fetal viability. And it prevents the government from punishing patients, healthcare providers, and those who assist someone seeking reproductive care, including abortion care. And we've seen those types of criminal and civil penalties enacted by other states across the country in an effort to deny an individual's right to an abortion. If we could go to the next slide, please. Is that the last that I... Uh-oh. Yeah, can you go back two slides, perhaps? So I intended to put up the actual text of the initiative, which, again, covers those sort of three general categories that I previously discussed. It's important to read the initiative. As with any initiative or any issue that's being put to voters, educate yourself on what is actually involved in the content of the measure that you're voting on. And it's important to do that because you're going to hear a lot of noise. You're going to hear a lot of ridiculous claims about the things that CI 128 does that are simply not true. The truth is that this amendment ensures that Montanans, everyday Montanans, can make decisions free from government intrusion. And it's an unfortunate sort of hypocritical reality that we live in these days, where extremist politicians talk about getting the government out of our lives, except when it comes to making important and private healthcare decisions within a family and in consultation with your medical provider. So this CI 128 and a vote yes on CI 128 will ensure that we can make those decisions without having legislators or extreme politicians tell us what we can and can't do with our bodies. So I'm looking forward to our question and answer session. Happy to chop it up with y'all about this initiative. But I encourage each one of you again to educate yourselves on what the initiative does and to support this, as we expect thousands and thousands of Montanans will do in the November election. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. Tom?
We're not going to have questions and answers following each segment?
No. Each of you give a presentation, then we'll take questions from the audience.
Okay. The proponent has said that he shortened his presentation by a few minutes, so we have time for a few library-oriented jokes.
Okay. Do you have a mic?
It does.
I'll speak closer. What advice do you get from a librarian? Thank you.
What advice do you get from a librarian?
Believe in your shelf. Why did the ghost... No, I don't want to do that one. What did the librarian tell the person who checked out 100 books? Don't overdo it. Where does the library keep books about Bigfoot? The large print section. I have that prerogative on the basis of my age.
Even if they're groaners, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
My words will not be a legalistic argument, but a personal statement. I'm not going to oppose just the initiative, but the practice. I could present information from Catholic bishops of Montana, the Montana Family Foundation, Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, or Lutherans for Life. I'm aware of the teachings of Steven Pinker and Michael Tooley justifying abortion. I will give very little that could be called an argument. This is a forum, not a debate. You probably know the arguments. In fact, in today's mail, the pro and con arguments came in our mailboxes. Some of them. You probably know the statistics and the polls. But the popular vote does not necessarily reflect the moral law. It can, but doesn't always. Sometimes majority rule is two wolves and a lamb deciding what to have for dinner. People have made up minds. People sometimes see the beliefs of others with abhorrence. I might consider your view, and you might consider mine in that light. Strangely, conflict is necessary for learning. So let's hear each other. For Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." I believe that every human being is amazingly unique, a child of the heavens, of heavenly parentage. We are created in the image and likeness of God. Every person is precious and inviolable. The earth is for people. The universe is not a cold, impersonal place where Richard Dawkins's selfish genes compete and everything is determined, as Robert Sapolsky writes. The greatest force in the universe is love. The materialist physicists such as Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan can't explain everything. There's still no satisfactory explanation even of consciousness, according to Eric Hoel. Man and woman bond in love, and life is the result. Love sparks life. What a miracle. A wonderful human being is created. Wordsworth wrote, "We come trailing clouds of glory from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy." I've been reading about some of my ancestors, colonists in the area of Kennebunkport, Maine, mid to late 1600s. A person has 4,000 direct line ancestors over 400 years. That we descend from them with such minimal disruption in genetic endowment is to me astounding. Abortion interrupts the generational connection upon which we rely for memory and identity. We belong to our generations. Abortion is anti-generative. I'm one of nine children. We grew up most years in Bear Canyon, about 8 miles to the east of here. We also lived in Deer Lodge, Baker, and Whitewater, Montana. We had a modest means, living at times in the open air, in a tent, in trailer homes, in half-built cabins, and drafty rentals. But we had lots of love. I am a beneficiary of the two-parent privilege. That's the title of Melissa Carney's book. Our parents' marriage was our haven. Life was based on religion, music, frugality, and hard work. It served us well. My mother has the treasure of 45 grandchildren and 68 great-grandchildren. Mom, raise your hand. You can be acknowledged.
Just walked in.
Yeah, good timing, Mom. I attend a family reunion every summer, which has been going for 66 years, with over 120 family members. Generational connections mean a lot to me. My wife and I are parents of four children and 10 grandchildren, 5 girls and 5 boys. It would bring me sorrow to know one of my granddaughters chose abortion, or that one of our grandsons paid for or encouraged an abortion. One of our granddaughters' conception was against the odds, not very probable. During the months she was preparing to enter independent mortal life, to be born, pictures of her showed no nose cartilage. The doctor said there could be a long list of genetic conditions. Technology could have cast her out. Her mother brought her to term and gave her birth. She is a bundle of curiosity and humor, with none of the concerns that the pictures predicted. It is a point of gladness that she is with us among the living. I think the Hippocratic Oath, which all doctors swore to until recently, is good guidance. It forbids abortion. Besides, we need the children. At current birth rate trends, population will halve every 75 years or so. That granddaughter I spoke of, by the time she's my age approximately, she will see a town and a country with only half the present population. This means empty buildings, silent streets and parks, few family ties, and a deficit of joy and connections. Thomas Malthus and Paul Ehrlich were wrong about an inexorable population explosion. Jesus said, "Let the little children come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Let the little children come." I invite you to join with me in voting no on CI 128.
Thank you. Okay, and now you get to ask questions. I would beg you, please, to not make a speech, to ask a question, and to limit that question. And you can address it to either or both of the representatives, but both get to make an answer. Does everybody get it? Okay.
And I may repeat the question just so everyone can hear it.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So who would like to be first? Yes, ma'am.
This question is for Mr. Wright. I'm just wondering, what is fetal viability? We know that heartbeats are beating at 6 weeks. You did not mention when fetal viability is.
Thank you. Did everybody hear the question? You nod.
Did everybody hear
do something?
When
okay,
is fetal
you
viability?
Heard it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I'll just be honest. I'm not a doctor. Fetal viability is going to be determined by the patient and her doctor. So that can come at any range. Typically, they say 20, 28 weeks. But at the end of the day, that determination is going to be made by a qualified healthcare provider, of which I am not. So, and again, the point of CI-128 is to ensure that those decisions around that are very private and very personal are going to be made by the patient in consultation with her qualified healthcare provider and not by the government.
Hang on a sec. Do you want to say something about that, Tom? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Just as a follow-up to that question and your answer, if it takes the patient's doctor to determine fetal viability, what happens when the broader term in the CI-128, which says healthcare provider, which does not limit that to a medical doctor, how do you, resolve that?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay, stick your hands up. I won't keep asking you, but if you didn't hear, stick your hands up, and then we'll repeat the question. Go ahead, Alan.
Sure. The question was around a qualified healthcare provider, and the Montana legislature previously tried to limit the provision of abortion care to a doctor, and that's what the original 1999 case Armstrong v. State was about. Was about whether or not physician assistants who were qualified to perform abortion services should be permitted to do so. And the court said yes, because under the physician assistants licensing standards, they were deemed competent for the provision of abortion care. Now, more recently, advanced practice clinicians can now perform abortion services. Currently, across the state of Montana, advanced practice clinicians and physician's assistants are doing something called miscarriage management. Miscarriage management is an identical procedure to the provision of an abortion. So what the courts have said is that you can't arbitrarily deny a healthcare provider to be providing the identical provision or the identical type of healthcare because one is called miscarriage management and one is called abortion. So again, to determine who a licensed or qualified healthcare provider is, that is up to the licensing boards. It's up to the board of medical examiners. It's up to the board of nursing to make those determinations. And when an individual is deemed competent within their scope of practice to provide any procedure, then they should be allowed to do so. And that's what CI-128 would protect.
Mr. Barnett, did you want to...
Yeah, did you want to say?
No.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Sally. There's so many questions you could ask, but I'm going to ask a legal question to the legal man in the room here, person in the room. Alex, have you by any chance read the paper recently produced by the former common law professor at U of M, Rob Nadelson, where he analyzed the amendment very thoroughly? If you happen to have seen that yet, if you have, I've got a question relative to that.
You're talking about my former con law professor, Rob Nadelson? yes. I can't say that I can recite it from memory, but I did review it.
Well, one specific point he made, and this is obviously it's available on the website of Independence Institute, that he is a fellow at, and I think the Montana Family Foundation, is the problematic, in his view, aspect of the amendment never using the word woman, never being gender-specific, that by avoiding the word woman, that it was potentially, through court cases and so on and so forth, opening up the applicability of the amendment in the
Roger.
Constitution.
Question.
It's important to various other things that don't even have to do with abortion, such as transgender, transitioning, and treatments, and men and women's sports and that sort of thing. Why was the word woman never used in the amendment?
Why was the word woman never used in the amendment?
Yeah, well, my ability to follow Professor Nadelson's reasoning is no better today than it was when I was in his constitutional law class 16 years ago. I don't think if you, and again, I commend each and every one of you to read the initiative. The initiative is about abortion, and it's about reproductive health care, and it's about keeping the government out of private decisions between an individual and her health care provider. So these arguments that somehow this initiative is a stalking horse intended to address something else, those are fanciful conjecture by people who are trying to scare individuals into not voting for this. This amendment is about protecting an individual's right to make important reproductive health care decisions free from government intrusion, plain and simple.
Could you answer my question? Why was the word woman never used in the amendment? People are concerned about that. It's an honest concern.
And by people, I assume you're referring to Professor Nadelson. The amendment was drafted for the purpose that it was intended, to protect abortion care. And the Montana Supreme Court has already said that the amendment is very clearly written, has been passed constitutional muster in terms of what it's addressing. And I think that voters understand what this is about, and they will turn out to support it in droves in November.
You didn't answer my question. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, in the back. Yes.
Alex, at what age does the government have a responsibility to protect a child?
Children already have protections under the Montana Constitution and under applicable law. So, again, this is not about protecting children. This is about protecting the right of an individual to make private health care decisions about their own body.
Okay, hang on. Over here. Yes, you, sir.
Who drafted this CI?
Who drafted?
Specifically.
So there was a group of individuals who worked on this initiative back a year ago. This has been considered for many months. And that group included people with Planned Parenthood. It included people with the ACLU. It included healthcare providers, abortion providers in the state. So I can't tell you an individual who is the architect of this initiative because it was a team effort. It certainly, you've seen other states where abortion has been placed on the ballot. Those states have resoundingly endorsed the right to an abortion, the right to make decisions free from government intrusion. And again, you see this type of language that tracks from other states and also from the Armstrong decision from 1999.
Yes, ma'am. Stand up, will you?
Do you know the percentage of the rates of births and abortions in Montana?
I do not.
The proportion of birth and abortion in Montana. Was the question. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Hi, and thank you for encouraging everyone to read the actual language of the amendment. This is the ballot language. Maybe perhaps we can get the actual amendment up. I'm 37 weeks pregnant, and so this issue hits me particularly hard this election cycle. When I read how viability is explained, at the bottom. I wonder if you can tell me, according to this language definitively, whether my 37-week pregnancy would be considered viable or not. I'm due to deliver in a couple of weeks.
Congratulations, first of all. As the father of two, I know that this is, I've been through the partner side of what you're going through, and it's an exciting moment. Again, I can't tell you what fetal viability is because I am not a healthcare provider. If your doctor determines that the fetus is viable, then the fetus is viable. And again, what the amendment does is it prohibits government regulation after viability, except where, or I'm sorry, it permits certain government regulation after fetal viability, except where the patient's life is at risk. And so there, the viability threshold is going to shift depending on what individual we are talking about. But that is for that is a determination that should not be made by the government. It's not the government's role to say when a fetus is viable. That is a determination that is made by a qualified healthcare provider in consultation with the patient.
So as a follow-up, sorry, would you say it's inconsistent to say that it's possible that a 40-week gestation pregnancy could be considered non-viable by a provider?
I'm not going to give you a satisfactory answer to that because I am not a healthcare provider that can make that determination.
Okay. Yes.
Why is the Constitution Amendment different than Roe v. Wade rates of doing things? Why did you change that?
Why is everybody heard?
No.
Why is everybody heard? Why is the why is this different than the language in Roe v. Wade?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Can you rephrase it?
So, and you guys are saying, well, I'm going to go, you know, and ask my provider, and the doctor is supposed to be the all-knowing one. That seems, you know, wrong. I mean, asking the professional class to make those type of decisions, and also, you know, it's like. Who says he's right? I mean, is there a board that reviews his decisions to see if they're correct? I mean, you know, at what time? I mean, it just seems like it's kind of, you know, open-ended. I mean, I've seen a lot of these, you know, the physician says it's okay, and so obviously we had a lot of marijuana, you know, tickets to go off and have medical marijuana, you know, so doctors aren't always the best choice for these things.
Okay.
Well, what I will say is that each medical provider in Montana is subject to a licensing board. They are subject to malpractice laws. So if, for example, they commit medical malpractice, they can be sued for that. And what I will also say is that we trust doctors to make medical decisions. And if we don't trust doctors and other healthcare providers who are deemed competent and qualified in their field to perform a service, then I don't know who else we trust. If I have a hip injury and I go to my orthopedic surgeon and the orthopedic surgeon recommends me for surgery, I can go get a second opinion, but I'm not going to go get a second opinion from the vet. I'm going to go get a second opinion from another orthopedic surgeon.
Okay, so it's mechanical. It has nothing to do with the morality in this situation. Because, I mean, you're talking about when it's viable. So apparently there's a moral decision being made.
I hear you. What about the morality question?
These are decisions, difficult decisions that are being made by an individual for whom morality obviously will play an important role in consultation with their healthcare provider.
Yes, you and the... Yeah, you.
Sorry. Currently in Montana, parental notification is required 48 hours prior to a minor 16 years or younger receiving an abortion. I believe CI 128 would remove this requirement, meaning that a 16-year-old or younger would receive an abortion without parental notification. Can you explain why that parental notification is being abolished by CA 128?
I didn't hear the question, so would you repeat it?
Sure. There is the question was around parental notification and sort of the intersection between CI 128 and parental notification.
For 16-year-olds and younger.
Right. Thank you. For minors, yes. So, yes, there were parental notification and parental consent laws that were passed, I believe, in 2021. Those are the subject of legal challenges currently. And the way that CI 128 will intersect with some of those issues is going to be defined by the courts. So there are certain, as with any constitutional initiative, there will be cases that are brought when the initiative is actually enshrined in the Constitution that explore the way that it's going to map onto everyday life in Montana. So parental notification is a good example of how of where, no doubt, there will be a question about whether parental notification is deemed a burden, an unnecessary burden, or state intrusion on the right of an individual to receive an abortion free from government intrusion. And my position is that it would not pass constitutional muster under CI-128.
Okay. I want to stop just for a second. Tom, you've been quiet about this. And this gentleman over here had raised the whole question of morality about this. Do you want to say something about that or not?
Sally, I came tonight urged by the organizers to be the opponent, and I prepared my remarks to be nice and tight and to address morality. So I'll just refer you back to my original comments. And I told organizers, I don't consider myself a good debater, and so I'm not prepared to rebut every contention. And I'm grateful that my opponent in the discussion is so respectful and so well qualified in his own realm, and that you are being respectful. And so I have covered the morality question in my remarks, Sally. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Yes.
Thank you both for being here today. It's really great that we have this forum to do this. Thank you, the moderator and League of Women Voters. My question is for Tom. You mentioned that in 75 years we could have half the population. Is that a suggestion that we require women to have children they may not want to have, i.e. take away their choice to have babies or not, require them to do it, so that we could not have, that would be the solution to the halving of our population? Is that what you're suggesting?
Thank you. That's an interesting logical connection. And no, of course. I'm not for compulsion. I'm just noting a societal trend.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Can you pull up the language?
Hang on a second. If it's not very long, maybe Alex would read it.
I'm happy to read it if that would be helpful to folks.
Is that okay, everybody? Okay.
Okay. It's small type, and I don't have my reading glasses, so bear with me. Section 36, right to make decisions about pregnancy. Section 1, there is a right to make and carry out decisions about one's own pregnancy, including the right to abortion. This right shall not be denied or burdened unless justified by a compelling government interest achieved by the least restrictive means. Section 2, the government may regulate the provision of abortion care after fetal viability, provided that in no circumstances shall the government deny or burden access to an abortion that, in the good faith judgment of the treating healthcare professional, is medically indicated to protect the life or health of the pregnant patient. Section 3, the government shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against a person based on the person's actual, potential, perceived, or alleged pregnancy outcomes. The government shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against a person for aiding or assisting another person in exercising their right to make and carry out decisions about their pregnancy with their voluntary consent. Section 4, definition section. For purposes of this section, A government interest is compelling, quote, compelling, only if it clearly and convincingly addresses a medically acknowledged bona fide health risk to a pregnant patient and does not infringe on the patient's autonomous decision-making. Section B, fetal viability means the point in pregnancy when, in the good faith judgment of a treating healthcare professional and based on the particular facts of the case, there is a significant likelihood of the fetus's sustained survival outside the uterus without the application of extraordinary medical measures.
That's a whole bill.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Everybody heard that? Okay. Hang on. Have you asked a question yet? Okay. Other people there were a bunch of hands. Yes, ma'am.
So, yes, on the second part, the government may regulate the provision of abortion care after fetal viability, provided that in no circumstance shall be the government deny or burden access to abortion that, in the good faith judgment of a treating healthcare professional. That's one of my first questions. So, is it not okay for a dentist to do an abortion or a medical assistant? Because this does not say that they have to be licensed. So a healthcare professional, from what I'm reading, can be anybody.
So again, healthcare professionals are licensed by the applicable, this is set up in statute by the state government to regulate that particular profession. So if a advanced practice clinician has been licensed in the provision of abortion care or miscarriage management, then they are deemed competent to provide those services based on their education, training, and skill. The same goes for a doctor. So there's nothing in this amendment that would permit a dentist or a naturopath to provide abortion care.
Where is it not there? I mean, healthcare professional are the words that are here. Those words do not eliminate other kinds of care. There's nothing in here that indicates that.
Because the provision of any medical care in Montana is licensed and governed by the applicable authorities. And so whether or not you're going in for a knee surgery or a abortion, those procedures must be carried out by people who are deemed competent by the applicable licensing boards and authorities in the state of Montana.
Okay.
Alex, I think she's asking, it says treating, it doesn't say license.
The what?
It says treating healthcare professional, it doesn't say license healthcare professional. Why wouldn't it say license if that's what?
Because the treating healthcare professional in this context is going to be the licensed individual who can provide abortion care services. So it would be what we call legally surplusage to include that language because it's already baked into the initiative that the person who is determined, who's making these determinations, are qualified to perform those services. And if they're not, then they're subject to all sorts of other penalties under pre-existing state law.
So I happen to be married to an attorney, and sometimes attorneys talk a certain way. I believe it's already made clear in the MCA that just not anybody can just, oh, I'm a healthcare professional. Is that what you're saying, Alex? It's provided for already in other law?
Correct.
Okay.
So in order to provide healthcare without being sued or being hauled into court, you need to be deemed competent within your scope of practice based on your education, skill, and training.
Okay. And the woman in the green sweater.
Well, I hear the words of this proposition being read over and over again, a competent healthcare physician to provide for the health of the woman who is pregnant. I don't hear anything in here that addresses the morality of abortion as taking the life of a child and the fetus in the womb. I have carried four children. You can, when you feel a child kick in your womb, there is an instant bond with that child. When they're born, there's an instant bond. I don't see anything in here as provision that protects the life and health of the child to be born.
Thank you.
And this is going to encourage and increase abortion in the state of Montana.
And
this passes. But anyway, how are you in this amendment protecting the life of the unborn child?
Thank you.
So the purpose of the amendment is to permit individuals to make private and deeply personal decisions in consultation with their qualified healthcare provider free from government intrusion. It's worth noting that since the Armstrong decision in 1999, this has been the law of the land in Montana. And in fact, since 1972, when our visionary constitutional convention delegates and framers enshrined the right to privacy in our Constitution, that this has been the law of the land. So CI 128 merely ratifies the existing law to ensure that extremist politicians are not going to consistently attempt to take away a right that is granted by the Montana Constitution.
I'm going to pick people who haven't asked a question. Yes, right, in the green and beige.
It's a lot.
Yeah, all that.
My question's for Alex. I'm trying to understand the woman's ability to make that decision. So it breaches viability, and she does not want to carry on the pregnancy. What does that look like? How long does she have to make that decision for herself and her family?
So it depends, again, on what regulation the state adopts, right? So the amendment does provide that there is certain regulation that the state can adopt post-viability, provided it does not threaten the life or health of the pregnant individual. So, you know, I'm not going to speculate on what those regulations look like. They could be any number of things, but even post-viability, an individual is still going to be able to access reproductive health care. It just is going to depend on what type of state regulation is adopted regulating post-viability procedures, and also the justification that the state adopts. So there's an important provision in the initiative talking about the compelling state interest that the government has. And it can't just be sort of a flimsy justification for adopting a rule. It can't be, we don't like abortion providers, so we're going to adopt this regulation, which is essentially what we've seen in recent legislation like House Bill 937 that targets abortion clinics with minimum hall width sizes, with, you know, sort of arbitrary regulations. The state has to come up with an actual justification for adopting those regulations. So to go back to your question, it's all going to depend, like that timing issue is all going to depend on whether or not the state has adopted a regulation, what that regulation looks like, and whether it's actually supported by a legitimate, or not a legitimate, a compelling state interest.
Okay. Yes, you.
Yes, sir. I have a question. You're a lawyer, correct? Mr.
Baker. No, yeah, I am a lawyer, indeed.
So I am not a lawyer. I was hoping you could provide some clarification on number 3. The government shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against a person based on the person's actual, potential, perceived, or alleged pregnancy outcomes. The government shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take adverse action against a person for aiding or assisting another person in exercising the right to make and carry out decisions about their pregnancy with their voluntary consent. It appears to me, just reading the ballot language, that none of the rest of it matters because the government can't take any action, no matter the outcome, so that it wouldn't matter why the abortion was provided, when it was provided, any of the circumstances. It looks like the government is not allowed to do anything about it. Is that a correct perception in your legal opinion?
So I'm not in a great position to offer a legal opinion on the ballot initiative because, again, the contours of the initiative will be explored, no doubt, through future litigation. But what this particular provision does is it prohibits the government from essentially criminalizing or penalizing people who are obtaining abortion care that's in alignment with the initiative language. So, you know, you can't, as in Texas, where you have Senate Bill 8, you can't put a bounty on individuals who are assisting an individual in seeking what is a legal right that is, at this point, enshrined in the Constitution. You can't criminalize an abortion provider for providing abortion care when that right is protected by the Constitution. That's what this provision is intended to do.
Okay. In the very back.
Hi, I'll speak up so we can all hear. My question tries to broaden this a little larger, and that is, why do states who have more restrictive abortion measures have higher rates of maternal mortality? And I'd like both gentlemen to answer.
Can you repeat that? Can that question be repeated?
Why do states which have, this is coming out of much research, from Tulane University, many universities. Why do states which have higher, states with higher abortion restrictions also have higher rates of maternal mortality?
Tom?
Gentlemen?
I will note that the answer to the question is baked into the question, that the presumption is that those states are causing abortion or maternal mortality. I don't know the statistics, but I just point out the conclusion that is embedded in the question.
And Alex?
Sure. So abortion care is health care. That is an important thing that we need to remember. And I am not an expert on the rates or the correlation that you identified, but the fact is that individuals in states that have restrictive abortion regimes are being placed at risk where they are bleeding out in the parking lot because they can't access necessary health care from an abortion provider. And I think that, again, I don't know what the statistics are, but the fact that health care is being denied in any context places individuals' lives at risk, and we should not countenance that in 2024.
You had a question right there.
Yes. I want to know, in the first place, when she approached me to sign that thing and asked me, I said, ask her, and so she is not Velveteer. She would pay. Yeah. Is that correct? And where does the money come from for that?
So there were paid signature gatherers, as there are with any ballot initiative that's necessary to qualify. I'm sorry, I was trying to speak. There are paid signature gatherers, as there are with any initiative that has historically qualified for the ballot in Montana. It's enormously difficult to obtain 60,000 signatures geographically dispersed across the state.
Where does the money come from?
So this is a homegrown effort that is being sponsored by organizations like mine, like ACLU of Montana, like Forward Montana, like Planned Parenthood of Montana. We have been fundraising in order to ensure that this initiative passes, and we have seen an overwhelming volume of contributions and support from Montana.
Okay. In the pink, in the very back. Pardon?
I'm an individual, I can
read it. Oh, okay. I'm trying to find people who haven't, you, right there, sir,
yes,
who haven't asked a question.
Yes, in reference to number 3 on there, as far as the protection against the doctor or the individual seeking the abortion, how about the doctor that refuses to do the abortion because he deems it not correct? How does this protect him against liability or lawsuits?
Interesting question.
Yeah, the initiative doesn't say anything about that doctor refusing to provide abortion services. This is simply about an individual consulting with their healthcare provider in order to obtain that care.
Okay. I'm trying to pick people who haven't asked a question. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, we're going to do this.
It does appear that item number 3 is of interest to many people. So, again, the last section, actually. The government shall not penalize, prosecute, or otherwise take advance action against a person for aiding or assisting another person in exercising their right to make their decisions about their pregnancy with their voluntary consent. My concern, and I would like your legal opinion as much as it is applicable, pregnancy is an incredibly, I'm sure many of you would agree, you have 2 children, so it's a very vulnerable moment. Maybe emotions aren't as stable as they would be. It is very difficult in those situations to make decisions, especially when one is pressured. I've had a close friend who was pressured to abort 2 of her children because there was concerns about development. Those children are 18 in college and 14. And so my concern is, what if there is pressure? Can that individual then bring a case against
the provider because they feel like they were coerced? I'm sorry, I misstated. Can the government, if they feel there's cause for a provider coercing individuals to have abortions, can the government not bring a case on behalf of its citizens for that coercion?
Yeah, so there are anti-coercion and intimidation statutes that already exist. This is going to be a really like pointy-headed lawyer thing to say, but I don't, without sort of digesting a fact pattern and then being able to apply it, it's really hard for me to answer your question. And I'm also just not entirely sure that I understand it. And so it feels, it would be malpractice of me to try to answer off the cuff for a question that I'm not entirely sure that I understand.
She wants to say it again.
Can she be more
shorter?
Okay.
If the government feels that there is a provider that is has a pattern of coercing individuals to have abortions that they then regret, may the government bring suit on behalf of those individuals against the provider for that abuse?
Again, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. I know that there exist protections against any healthcare provider that is coercing an individual into receiving treatment. I'm not sure I'm familiar with any real-life examples of that happening, but there are patient protections that exist against predatory tactics by healthcare providers, for sure.
I'm going to ask you a question. And the patient can always sue the physician or the healthcare provider for whatever, can't they?
Yeah, unless and until extremist politicians take away medical malpractice, there is always a availability to bring a lawsuit against a healthcare provider who is violating the standard of care.
Thank you. Just the man in the very back.
And you guys, this needs to be our last question.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
You guys, this needs
I just
to
want to say thank you for taking
question.
This. Yeah, okay. My last question. Just a question for both of you, or I think for you, Alex. You talked about in the opening, but I just want to make sure that I'm understanding why, with the Armstrong protections, why this initiative right now in Montana? So maybe you could just answer that. And again, thank you for taking time for this last question.
Why initiative now is your question?
Sure. Okay. Thanks for the question.
Thanks to you, too.
The goal, one of the goals with this initiative is to definitively put this issue to rest. And yes, we have had abortion protections in the state since Armstrong was decided in 1999. But just within the last two legislative cycles, we've seen a 20-week ban adopted. We've seen telehealth restrictions. We've seen a 24-hour waiting period. We've seen fetal ultrasound bill, restriction on dilation and evacuation abortions, denial of Medicaid for abortion services, parental consent laws, targeted restrictions on abortion providers, restrictions on who can provide an abortion. These bills, these laws, were enacted over the course of the last several legislative sessions, even when the courts have said that abortion is legal in Montana, and CI 128 will, with finality, make certain, in no uncertain terms, that the right to an abortion exists in the Montana Constitution, and any future change in the complexion of the court, as we saw with the U.S. Supreme Court, will not impact an individual's right to obtain abortion services in Montana in perpetuity.
Okay. Tom?
I won't put words in the mouth of the proponents for their timing on this. I could come up with a couple of reasons, but they wouldn't be that informative. And I'll just take their claims at face value.
So each of the panelists will give their concluding remarks, but I want to start with the concluding remarks, and since I'm in the middle, I get to. I've been doing this for years, been doing Canada forums and issue forums for years in Montana, and this is probably the most contentious. I want to thank you all for your being considerate, and paying attention and being thoughtful and kind to one another. And I'm very appreciative of that. This is a tough, tough issue for everybody in the world, I think. So with that, you want to start first, Tom, as a concluding remarks?
Let's let Alex go first. I want to find something.
Okay. He's finding something.
No fair. I went first before. Now I'm not going to give you time to track down some enlightening quote that's going to... Sure, I will dive in. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about this important issue tonight. I appreciate hearing your questions, talking through an issue, as Sally said, that is very deeply personal to all of us. CI-128 is an important initiative this election cycle that we believe will, again, ensure that an individual can make healthcare decisions in consultation with their family and healthcare provider in perpetuity. And that's the point of putting it in our Montana Constitution. It's important to vote in November, and we all will do that. Whether or not you support the initiative, we all need to go vote. I would be remiss if I didn't point out Dylan, who's working with our campaign. He has materials for the initiative if you're interested in supporting it, if you're interested in knocking on doors and getting out in the field to talk to voters about this important issue, please track us down. You can contact us through our website. But we all have an important role to play, and that's the ballot initiative process itself is about letting voters have their voice heard, and we are looking forward to the voice of Montana being heard in November.
Okay. No, I'm sorry. Tom?
In this case, the personal is cosmic. And to put a little meat on that, on those bones, here's a paragraph from the book Witness by Whitaker Chambers, the American communist spy who renounced and repudiated his communism. I date my break from a very casual happening. I was sitting in our apartment on St. Paul Street in Baltimore. It was shortly before we moved to Alger Hiss's apartment in Washington. My daughter was in her high chair. I was watching her eat. She was the most miraculous thing that had ever happened in my life. I liked to watch her even when she smeared porridge on her face or dropped it meditatively on the floor. My eye came to rest on the delicate convolutions of her ear, those intricate, perfect ears. The thought passed through my mind. No, those ears were not created by any chance coming together of atoms in nature, the communist view. They could have been created only by an immense design. The thought was involuntary and unwanted. I crowded it out of my mind, but I never wholly forgot it or the occasion. I had to crowd it out of my mind. If I had completed it, I should have had to say, design presupposes God. I did not then know that. At that moment, the finger of God was laid upon my forehead. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for coming, everybody.
Yes, thank you for coming.
That was a forum on CI-128, an upcoming ballot initiative in the 2024 general election. This meeting was held at the Bozeman Public Library on September 30th, 2024.